This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
And it has been difficult on the part of the verification visa center, VFS, to accommodate everyone.
That was Ngaka Buto Mabena, chairperson of the Zimbabwe Community in South African Organization, discussing South Africa's difficulties in processing new residency permits. Details coming up. Also, the United States halts food aid to Ethiopia, while Namibia's parliament will consider the law on same-sex marriage. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The U.S. Agency for International Development said today it is suspending food aid to Ethiopia because its donations were being diverted from people in need. USAID said it had determined in coordination with the Ethiopian government that there has been a widespread and coordinated campaign in diverting food assistance. The statement did not say who was responsible or whether the aid went. However, Reuters News says it has seen an internal briefing by a group of foreign donors to Ethiopia that USAID thinks the food was diverted to Ethiopian military units. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said he welcomed the Ethiopian government's commitment to investigate the matter. Abraham Zare from VOA's Horn of Africa service is here in the studio to discuss the U.S. aid decision. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Abraham.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, Abraham, talk to me about the diversion of aid and the possible government involvement.
That's interesting. So Ethiopia is the largest recipient of U.S. food aid in the world.
Recipient of food aid?
In the world. And now we see U.S. aid and the WFP have stopped donating the aid, alleging that the government plus regional governments are diverting the aid to military to an extent where they say they're even selling it to, repackaging and selling it to other countries like Kenya, Somalia, and other countries, neighboring countries. So this has been a big ongoing investigation for USAID and other organizations. Now they decided to stop it now.
So actually, U.S. Secretary Blinken met with the Ethiopian Deputy Prime Minister and Foreign Minister Demeke Mekonnen on the margins of the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS, Islamic State in Saudi Arabia. And he welcomed the government's commitment to investigate. So the minister is what, investigating his own government?
That's what it seems. I guess that's kind of a gesture saying, unless you investigate these things, we'll suspend our aid. Otherwise, as the report says, the government is part of the scheme. The regional government and the government itself is part of this scheme. Like, they are diverting the aid to the military, and they have been involved in one way or another in repackaging the aid. USAID said they have visited 63 flour mills across the country, where they have seen repackaging of their aid, either to be sold outside or be diverted to the military. So the government is part of the scheme. So it's difficult to investigate its own misdoing, I guess.
So let's break it down. So what you're saying is there is the federal government and the regional governments. So the regional governments, in collaboration with the federal government, are scheming off the aid money.
Yes, as the report says, yeah.
So, Abraham, the Ethiopian government, you know, this kind of thing where when aid is suspended, there are ramifications. And basically, we know there was a great deal of, there was a civil war in Tigray, and people were dying, and this aid comes at an opportune time, and now it's suspended. So, will it exacerbate the situation even more now for the people who are actually relying on the aid?
According to the UN reports, 20 million Ethiopians are waiting for, expecting of aid, depend on aid, food aid. So with this now, definitely across the regions, in all the conflict areas like Amhara, Tigray, Afar, plus Oromia, which is also in conflict, also Benshangul Gumbaz, on top of that, we also have other droughts in Oromia region. So all this will be affected majorly by the aid, suspension of the aid. And we also with internal conflict. They can't farm their farms. They can't cultivate their properties. So they are both affected by the drought, by suspension of the aid, plus the war. So three things combined worsen the situation, I guess.
So it's not only for the Tigray region. You're talking about basically all of Ethiopia.
It's across Ethiopia, yeah, definitely.
And talking about the Tigray region, you know, there was, we followed almost 2 years, the uprising over there and the war. How are things in Tigray now? Have things quieted down? People, normal lives there?
Quiet down for a little bit, but we still have many issues. Like, let's say, initially we were reporting about war. Now we are reporting about demonstrations, about dismantling of people, let's say. Some of the former combatants, disabled former combatants, would do some demonstration today. Next day, people who are pensioners would do demonstration asking for their assistance. Third day, teachers would do something. So we are kind of seeing the effects of the war now in the Tigray. Although we have administration, we have the structure intact, but we still have many issues to... And we are seeing the consequence of the war only now.
And the suspension of this U.S. aid...
would also worsen the situation, yeah.
Abraham Zare, team leader of VOA's Tigray program, thanks for your input.
Thank you for having me.
Close to 200,000 Zimbabweans in South Africa are breathing a sigh of relief after the Department of Home Affairs delayed the pending expulsion by 6 months. The department earlier had given Zimbabwe exemption permit holders until June 30th to leave if they could not obtain other residency permits. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
The Minister of Home Affairs, Aaron Motsoaledi, said the extension has been given for Zimbabweans to apply for other visas and waivers. He also ordered that they be not arrested or deported because of expired permits. It's the third time the expulsion grace period has been extended. The government had said nearly 200,000 people holding Zimbabwe exemption permits would have to leave the country by the end of this month. Ngabuto Mabena, chairperson of the Zimbabwe Community in South Africa organization, told VOA they welcome the extension.
It became clear to us that they were not going to be able to meet their own deadline because many people have been applying and it has been difficult on the part of the verification visa center, VFS, to accommodate everyone.
However, Freeman Bengu, who recently led a march against the presence of illegal foreign nationals in the country, told VOA they are disappointed by the extension.
This is going to affect negatively to our South Africans who are unemployed because of the ZEPs. We've got such a high unemployment rate in South Africa that we need all avenues possible for us to employ our people.
There has been rising anti-foreigner sentiment in the country, driven in part by an unemployment rate topping 30% and a fragile economy. Many ZEP holders had filed a court case challenging their expulsion. Legal expert Vusumuzi Sbanda told VOA the pending court ruling on the case will likely not change the decision to extend.
If the court says people should go, that will not really change anything because there is a current extension that goes up to, you know, 31 December. So that means that the going will have to be over 31. I mean, after the 31st of December, then Home Affairs will not then extend. And if the court says, you know, they should stay beyond that and gives a period of time, then it means that that court decision is what is going to be bound by.
These Zimbabweans have expressed their unwillingness to leave after residing in South Africa for over a decade, during which they had acquired assets and established professions and families. Reporting for VOA News in Johannesburg, I am Tuso Kumalo.
Pope Francis was in good general condition today following a three-hour operation yesterday to remove intestinal scar tissues and repair a hernia in his abdominal wall. The Vatican said the 86-year-old Francis rested extensively overnight at Rome's Gemelli Hospital. Francis entered the hospital yesterday for his second major abdominal operation in 2 years, following a 2021 procedure to remove part of his colon. His medical team says the operation was a success with no complications, and the Pope should be fine after he recovers. The pontiff is expected to remain in the hospital for several days, and all the papal audiences were canceled through June 18th. Doctors, however, say he should be able to take scheduled trips to Portugal and Mongolia in August. You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. An international war crimes court ruled this week that Rwandan genocide suspect Felicien Kabuga is unfit to stand trial. It was determined he suffers from dementia. The court will proceed with a slimmed-down case considering the facts of the case. Rwanda's ambassador in the Netherlands says the decision is a disservice to the victims of the 1994 genocide in the country. Ambassador Oliver Ndungira spoke with Edward Ruima of VOA Central Africa Service, and here is a portion of their discussion.
This situation was caused first and foremost by the fact that Felicien Kabuga was allowed to escape justice for more than 20 years. Now we have this situation where we don't have a full trial. It's a disappointment, of course, for the victims of the genocide and for the government and for those who wanted justice for the victims. We would have preferred, in normal circumstances, that the trial goes to a full decision with a conviction of Felicien Kabuga. It's a disappointment, but we will, of course, follow the case in its new format, and then hope that the court will take the right decision.
What precedent do you think this is setting when Rwanda still has a lot of fugitives that is still trying to pursue, and most of them are also getting old, they're getting frail? Do you think at the end of the day, justice is going to be served?
As I said, this is the direct consequences of this of the situation of allowing genocide fugitives to escape justice for a long period. Since 1994, Rwanda sent abroad more than 1,000 arrest warrants, but among them, only few of them were acted upon by the countries. We have extraditions from a number of countries, but also trials in the countries, in the host countries. But the majority of those indictments are still there without any prosecution. So this should be a lesson for us, and then for countries in the world where we send those indictments, that it's important to collaborate with Rwanda, but also with the tracking unit of the mechanism in order to give justice to the victims.
Ambassador Oliver Ndungira is Rwanda's ambassador to the Netherlands. He was speaking with Edward Ruima of VOA Central Africa Service. Egypt's President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi and Qatar's Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thana have agreed to launch a joint initiative to aid and support Sudan as its military and the paramilitary rapid support forces continue to battle for control of the country. Amir Hamzoui, director of Carnegie's Middle East program, explained to VOA's analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi how crucial Egypt is to securing stability in Sudan and what role, if any, can Egypt play to help restore peace there.
Sudan is key to Egyptian national security at many different levels. Border security, historically speaking, has been a key component of Egyptian interests in Sudan. Water security has been a second key component in Egypt's relationship with Sudan and bilateral Egyptian-Sudanese coordination vis-a-vis Ethiopia, which has been building its Grand Renaissance Dam and trying to impose its will on Sudan and Egypt without any respect for binding international regulations pertaining to multi-country rivers. Thirdly, Sudan is key for Egypt's role in the region. It's part of how Egypt appeals to regional actors and to international powers as a force of stability in the Middle East and North Africa. Egypt has been siding in general with all attempts on the Arab side, on the African side, and internationally to mediate between the two adversaries or two enemies. However, to no avail. Egypt will have to continue its mediation and its negotiations alongside the US, alongside the European Union, the African Union, and the UN, and two key Arab countries, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, which for different reasons have come to be key players in Sudan as well. So Egypt cannot do it on its own. It will have to join an orchestrated regional international effort, hoping to convince the leadership of the Sudanese army and the leadership of the paramilitary troops to sit down and negotiate in good faith.
So how do you explain the inability of the Arab League and the African Union to play the mediation role between the warring sides in Sudan?
The Arab League and the African Union have issued different statements calling on Sudanese actors to stop their military confrontation and sit down at a negotiating table, not only to figure out a safe or an orderly path toward democratic governance, but to figure out representation and distribution of resources issues pertaining to the relationship between the central government and the different regions, as in Darfur, Kordofan, and different regions in Sudan. However, these calls do not come with any binding power. It comes down to what General Hamiti on the one hand, what the leadership of the Sudanese army on the other hand, how they perceive the battlefield. If they continue to perceive it as a place where they can deal the adversary a decisive defeat, that they will continue to fight, and they have their networks of regional and international support. They are still getting arms, they are still getting supplies, they are still able to operate financially and economically to sustain some revenues. And as long as this continues to exist, they will not stop. It's only when they realize it's a dead end and no defeat will happen in a decisive fashion that they will start realizing it's in their best interest to sit down and negotiate and find a compromise that can only look like integrating the paramilitary troops in the professional army. We do not know, in the region and outside the region, we do not know of a single country that has managed to stabilize post-civil war conditions with a duality in the armed forces or who claims monopoly over the legitimate use of coercive power.
Could the continued conflict threaten another partitioning of Sudan?
I hope not. This is a vast country, a huge territory with huge resources, with a population that is diverse, that could have added to the country's riches. However, Sudan has lived in civil war since the 1950s. South Sudan seceded, created its own republic. There was a brutal civil war in Darfur, northwest of Sudan, resulting in mass killing and atrocities that have been reported worldwide, leading to former President Bashir being on the wanted list of the International Criminal Court. Unfortunately, this is not far from what Sudan has been going through in recent times. I hope this can be averted by successful negotiations. And I also hope that once they come to sit down, they will not only negotiate a truce or a ceasefire, but they will negotiate a permanent solution that will have to include, once again, agreements on this just distribution of the resources. It cannot be that remote regions continue to be marginalized and excluded from the wealth of the country and the capital city of Khartoum and its ruling establishment, its elites, its cronies continue to possess most of what this country has to offer.
That was Amer Hamzoui, director of Carnegie's Middle East program. He spoke with my colleague Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Some legal experts say South African government officials could be charged as accessories to war crimes should they not arrest Russian President Vladimir Putin if he visits Johannesburg for the summit of the BRICS countries in August. The International Criminal Court has issued a warrant for Putin's arrest for war crimes allegedly committed in Ukraine. As a member of the ICC, South Africa is obliged to take the Russian leader into custody, but the government says it will not. Darren Taylor reports.
Several sources in South Africa's ruling African National Congress, including former President Kgalema Motlanthe, say Russian President Vladimir Putin will not attend the August meeting in person. This, they say, is partly because that would make the South African government vulnerable to prosecution or civil suits. International Criminal Court law experts have told VOA that South Africa's Minister of International Relations, in particular, would be at risk of prosecution for aiding and abetting a war criminal. The ICC indicted Putin for war crimes following Russia's invasion of Ukraine last year. International Relations Minister Naledi Pandor says she looks forward to hosting her Russian friends, including Putin, in August. He's accepted an invitation to attend the summit of the BRICS nations, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. The ANC has close ties with Moscow. The former Soviet Union supported the ANC's struggle against apartheid, and the party has refused to condemn Putin's invasion of Ukraine. Pretoria joined Russia in military exercises this year, and Moscow has promised South Africa increased economic and military cooperation. Emil Mayburg is a South African advocate who advises several governments on ICC law.
It also prohibits anybody from impeding the work of the International Criminal Court. And my view is that by not executing an arrest warrant, as we are obliged to, we are actually impeding the work of the International Criminal Court. Furthermore, the statute is very clear that victims of war crimes can claim reparations from the perpetrators. And in my view, it would certainly be a good case to make out by a Ukrainian victim to say, listen, I've suffered because of your failure to uphold your part of the convention, and therefore you owe me money.
The government says its lawyers are exploring ways for Putin to attend the summit in person without being arrested. But Mayburg says they have no room for maneuver, and the sooner they move the BRICS summit meeting online or to China, the better for South Africa.
That is the best that we can do. We have to be honest with our friend Vladimir Putin and say, buddy, I'm sorry, we have to arrest you. Best is you don't come here. Moving the meeting elsewhere is a capitulation, but I think that's the best that the government can do to avoid having to arrest Vladimir Putin coming to South Africa.
BRICS foreign ministers recently met in South Africa and called for what they said should be a rebalancing of the world order away from Western nations, and pledged to provide global leadership in addressing inequality and insecurity. They also discussed expanding the group to include other nations. Just 2 days ago, Minister in the Presidency Kumbudzo Nachaveni told ENCA News South Africa would not surrender its right to host the BRICS summit. The government says it alone will decide on Putin's attendance, with President Cyril Ramaphosa set to make a pronouncement soon. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Adrias Rigas, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
VOA Africa Radio, we let the sound tell you the story. News, sports, science, and entertainment available to you 24/7. Tune in on your local FM stations. We are also available on the medium waves, 909 kHz and 1530 kHz. Our short waves are 60-80,
15 580, 4930, 15 165, 15 580, and 17 530 kilohertz. VOA Africa, your trusted source